Lights.
Camera.
Brain. Action.
The 4th Annual Dionysus Awards.
For the most philosophically compelling movies of 2011.
And the nominees are...
For the most philosophically ambitious movie imaginable, The Tree of Life.
You are not to call me Dad. You will call me Father. But don't interrupt. Don't interrupt.
For the most philosophically rich depiction of sadism and masochism in human life.
A Dangerous Method.
If there is one thing I've learned in my short life, it's this. Never repress anything.
For the most philosophically courageous and unrelenting film.
We need to talk about Kevin.
Just because you're used to something doesn't mean you like it. You're used to me.
Join us as we explore the most philosophically interesting movies of the year.
The 2012 Dionysus Awards, coming up on Philosophy Talk. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of KALW San Francisco.
We're continuing conversations that started down the road at Stanford University, where Ken and I are professors of philosophy.
And today, it's our 4th annual Dionysus Awards show.
The Dionysus Awards are presented to the most philosophically interesting movies of the year. Sometimes, when we feel like it, we also honor philosophically notable movies from the past.
Now, unlike your average award show, we accept nominations from the floor. So we'll be talking to some of our listeners who wrote in with their own suggestions, and also to some special guests.
To win a Dionysus Award, a movie has to be interesting from a philosophical point of view. It could present a morally complex vision of human life, like The Reader did.
To make room, you were picking women out and saying you and you and you have to be sent back to be killed.
Well, what would you have done?
It may force us to think about our own prejudices and stereotypes, like District 9 did.
I mean, you can't say they don't look like that. That's what they look like, right? They look like prawns.
It may take us to the boundaries of reality, like Inception. Or it may challenge the line between appearance and reality, like Black Swan, both past winners.
How about I dance the Black Swan for you?
Now, the movies to which we give a Dionysus Award have to be philosophically ambitious and compelling, but they also need to be good movies, well-executed films.
I saw a number of movies I like this year, and some of them have gone on to be nominated for Academy Awards. Films like The Artist, which I really loved, Moneyball, War Horse, and The Help. Some of these touched on philosophical themes, but that wasn't what they were really about. Fine for the Oscars, but not for the Dionysus Awards.
And one of those films, The Help, its reception raised a lot of interesting issues, I think, a lot of philosophical issues. That's because it had this kind of bifurcated reception. Many in the Black community thought it was yet another example of one of Hollywood's, I think, really bad habits. That's the habit of supposing that if you're going to tell a story about a Black person, you better tell it through the eyes of a white person. That's the only way it's going to have a chance of being a hit in the mainstream box office.
Well, there's some interesting philosophical issues there in the reception to The Help. But The Help itself, I don't think it's Dionysus worthy.
No, I think you're right. I think the movie itself, does it help to illuminate the nature of our racial attitudes or the nature of racism? Not in any very deep or challenging ways.
It was a good year for movies about dysfunctional families. There was a Descendants and Hannah. Hannah got a couple of nominations. It was about a young lady raised by her father to be an extremely effective killer. So it raised the issue of free will, but in my opinion, not in a philosophically very interesting way.
Totally agree, John. Now, you know, throughout this show, we'll be talking about some mainstream movies with thought-provoking themes, but many philosophically interesting movies first appear outside the mainstream, outside Hollywood, at some small film festival or other. And these film festivals have become central to the hopes of serious filmmakers, and new festivals are cropping up every year.
We sent our roving philosophical reporter, Caitlin Esch, to the Santa Barbara Film Festival. There she looked for philosophical films from budding young filmmakers. She files this report.
At the Santa Barbara International Film Festival, actors including Christopher Plummer from the movie Beginners and Viola Davis from The Help were honored, along with Martin Scorsese, director of Hugo. But there were also dozens of younger, lesser-known directors, actors, and producers making career debuts, and many philosophical films. Take the animated short Cadaver. Writer and director Jonah Ansel says he wanted to explore what it means to love someone, only to discover a betrayal after death that changes everything.
I want to live. I want to give.
In the film, an old dead guy, played by Christopher Lloyd, comes back to life after his heart is taken out during an autopsy. He proclaims his heart belongs to his wife and sets out to give it back to her. Then he discovers a truth he never learned in life.
Romantic vows indeed deceive and crush what I wear on my sleeve.
Love has become sappy and commercialized and cheap.
Director Jonah Ansel.
From the Kardashians to Hallmark, whatever it means to love anymore and how you manifest that through behavior, through marriage, through whatever it might mean, I wanted to tell a story that I actually emotionally believed in that would actually resonate with someone who is a cynic or a romantic.
And then there was The Kill Hole, a feature film by Portland-based director Misha Webley. A troubled Iraq War veteran struggles to put his life back together, but he's haunted by the brutal atrocities he committed during the war. Here he is talking to his counselor.
What makes what I did wrong?
Look, there's nothing right about what they asked us to do. You gotta remember that.
I did bad things. Really bad things.
Webley used real veterans to shoot the group therapy scenes. He says the stories they told were so moving that people working on the set were reduced to tears.
The idea really is that you go through an experience like that, you're fighting in combat, you have to really shift entirely how you think and how you react to things. They say it's 90% boredom, 10% terror, you know, and you do that for long periods of time. Coming home, it's very hard to turn that off. In order to fight a war effectively as a soldier, you have to switch something in your brain. It's part of the training.
The Santa Barbara Film Festival also features several philosophical documentaries. Dirty Energy is a film by Brian Hopkins about the impact of the BP oil spill off the coast of Louisiana. Here's a scene where a seafood distributor gets angry over the slow and incomplete cleanup.
You think we stupid? We're not stupid. Y'all putting oil on the bottom of our fishing rod. Y'all not only messing me up now, y'all messing me up for the rest of my life.
Director Hopkins says the potential cost of the spill is an entire culture. From the Cajuns who live without electricity to the third-generation shrimpers.
Most people aren't third-generation anything anymore. And the idea of all that knowledge being passed down, and he's like, this is all I know. If I can't do what I have been born, bred, and raised into, then who am I?
Other philosophical documentaries to look out for are Sunday in Brazzaville and Surviving Progress. Such films are being made all over the world by young filmmakers. You just have to seek them out. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Caitlin Esch.
I'm John Perry. With me is Ken Taylor.
We're talking about the most philosophically interesting movies of 2011. It's the fourth annual Dionysus Awards.
You know, Ken, one of the great philosophical directors of our age is Woody Allen. He does have a hit movie this year, Midnight in Paris, and it's nominated for an Academy Award for Best Picture.
And it is a little philosophical, John. There is this extended reflection on nostalgia and what it means to live in the past, whether nostalgia is a form of denial, and it comes out with an answer to that. And it's a beautiful movie, and if you love art and you love literature, all these great figures of art and literature appear in the movie. It's really cool. But it's kind of philosophically light, especially if you want to compare it to Woody Allen's body of work. It really punches below Woody Allen's normal philosophical weight.
Well, I agree. I don't think we can give a Dionysus Award to Midnight in Paris, but hey, Ken, maybe we could give Woody Allen a Lifetime Achievement Dionysus Award. I think my favorite film from a philosophical point of view, and maybe my favorite Woody Allen film altogether, is Love and Death. This was one of the last, maybe the last film he made in his kind of purely comic phase before the darker phase set in. And it's a spoof on a Dostoevsky, Tolstoy-type Russian novel that goes on and on and on, and all sorts of bad things happen to people and deals with the themes of love and death.
To love is to suffer. To avoid suffering, one must not love. But then one suffers from not loving. Therefore, to love is to suffer, not to love is to suffer. To suffer is to suffer.
But what's philosophical about it is that he really does deal with those themes, and he does so in a humorous way, and gives you, at least I got the message from it, that, well, maybe God is dead, but humor isn't, and it still gives us some way of dealing with things. And it has some really good lines, like...
If it turns out that there is a God, I don't think that he's evil. I think that the worst you can say about him is that basically he's an underachiever.
So that would be my contribution to justifying a Lifetime Achievement Dionysus Award for Woody Allen.
One of my favorite all-time movies of Woody Allen is really dark, is unrelentingly dark, is Match Point. And I think this is such a tight, disciplined, amazing movie. This movie is about there is utterly no justice in the universe. Life is utterly governed by chance, not our virtue, not our morality. It's utterly governed by chance. There is no guarantee that the good will triumph, that the wicked will get their comeuppance. It's very bleak. The opening scene is of this tennis ball balancing on the net, because the movie is about a tennis player who can't stand the competition, who gets out of the game, but he was really good, but he couldn't stand the stress of losing. And losing often for him came down to just... the ball balancing on the net.
And for a split second, it can either go forward or fall back. With a little luck, it goes forward and you win. Or maybe it doesn't and you lose.
But it turns out that his whole, he does something very, very bad. He falls in love with his brother-in-law's girlfriend and they have this affair, but he's married to the sister and he's getting rich and all this stuff. And something happens in the end. Well, I won't give it away. But a crucial scene in the movie, he throws an object that balances on a rail. And if it falls one way, his life is going to go one way. He's going to be found out and he's going to go to jail and he's going to rot in hell. If it falls another way, he's going to get off, right? So it exactly echoes that previous scene from the very first opening thing when you don't know what's coming. And it is so brilliant, so revelatory. And the way the movie ends is, oh, man. So that's a great movie. Anybody who can make a movie like Match Point, that guy has my undying admiration as a philosophical filmmaker.
So it's agreed. Midnight in Paris doesn't get a Dionysus Award, but Woody Allen gets a Lifetime Achievement Dionysus Award for a lifetime of philosophically compelling movies.
Awards. They do nothing but give out awards. I can't believe it.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. It's the fourth annual Dionysus Award Show, honoring the most philosophically rich movies of 2011.
Coming up, we'll take nominations from listeners and from a few special guests. And Ken and I will announce winners in two categories, the most philosophically courageous and unrelenting film and the most philosophically ambitious movie imaginable.
Dionysus Award winners plus nominations from the floor when Philosophy Talk continues.
Muppet, a song nominated for an Oscar this year. This is Philosophy Talk, and we're giving out the Dionysus Awards for the best philosophical films of 2011. I'm John Perry, and with me is Ken Taylor.
You know, John, somehow the Muppets failed to make our list of movies to honor this year.
Before we get to this year's Dionysus Award for the most philosophically ambitious movie imaginable, we're joined by Tim Sika, president of the San Francisco Film Critics Circle. Welcome back to the Dionysus Awards, Tim.
Thank you, guys. It's a pleasure to be here always.
So, Tim, what's the most philosophically rich film you've seen this past year?
Well, a little film called We Need to Talk About Kevin. It's directed by Scottish filmmaker Lynn Ramsey, who is just a genius at dark subject matter. She directed a couple films, one called Ratcatcher and one called Morven Caller. But We Need to Talk About Kevin is based on the 2003 novel by Lionel Shriver. And it's basically about the relationship of a mother, played by Tilda Swinton, with her very willful, let's just say, son, and very recalcitrant son, played by Ezra Miller.
I mean, it's got so bad that half the time the people on TV, inside the TV, they're watching TV. And what are all these people watching? People like me.
When you say willful and recalcitrant, I think you're a little bit understating it. I don't want to give away the ultimate culmination of this movie, but let's say something very dark and bad happens in connection with this son's life. And the movie...
He does something very naughty.
The movie is told sort of in two ways, right? There's the mother has flashbacks to her own youth as a bohemian travel writer going forward, right? There's sort of the unfolding narrative of her life, her son's life, her marriage, all this sort of stuff. And then there's her in the present, thinking very remorsefully, very torn about all this stuff. She's lost everything, and she's ruminating about what she could have done differently and what her responsibility was. And both of these, both the forward part and the flashbacks, they're both very riveting.
When he was a baby, he never stopped screaming. I thought maybe it had damaged his hearing.
No, his hearing's fine.
But shouldn't he be talking by now? I read somewhere that non-verbalizing was an early sign of autism.
He has none of the telltale rocking signs. I wouldn't worry about it too much.
All the tropes of child rearing are in this movie, and they're turned on their head. You know, if you do this, then this will happen. You know, boys will be boys. Don't worry about that. I loved it because it kind of posits, what do you do when you, as a parent, get dealt an inscrutable hand?
The problem with the mother is, she's really utterly exasperated. She's trying hard to be a good parent. There are all these scenes. There's this lovely scene of her playing ball with a couldn't be more than, what, 2 or 3 years old mm-hmm. with Kevin, and he just refuses to play. He won't get potty trained until, I don't know how old he is, but 6 or 7. He takes delight in pooping in his pants when he's 6 or 7 years old and kind of, you know, rubbing his recalcitrant in his parents' face.
Kevin, could you say mommy for me?
No.
Mommy?
No.
Just say mommy.
No.
I don't think the mother is portrayed to us as a sympathetic character. I think we're at a great distance from her because she comes really unhinged and, you know, and she's completely unhinged. So this movie doesn't really give us anybody to sympathize, to empathize with.
Well, you know, I guess I disagree. I found her a very sympathetic character. The one scene that I thought brought out the most was the one you mentioned where she's rolling the ball back and forth, particularly the one time he rolled the ball back. And she just lit up, and the bonding was there on her part. She was ready to bond, but he was just playing with her. The next time, he wouldn't roll it back. In philosophy, we have this concept of moral luck, right? You do something, and in the circumstances, it may lead to a disaster, in which case you've done a bad thing, or it may not, in which case maybe you've done a good thing. I think parenting is a lot like that. With a different child, it would have grown up fine. I think the movie, to me, emphasized that we need to get away, and we have gotten away from the kind of Freudian picture that everything that goes wrong in a child's life is due to some screw-up on the part of the parents.
You know, just on another level here, too, one of the things I thought was interesting in the character of the father, played by John C. Reilly, this notion of how optimism can sort of foster a kind of blindness or short-sightedness and kind of a delusion. You know, Kevin's dad is constantly rationalizing and dismissing his wife's concern over Kevin's behavior with phrases like, oh, that's what boys do. And he holds on to this notion that if you believe in it strongly enough, you say and do all the right things, that you can have this Norman Rockwell family life. You know, there's a great scene where Eva, Kevin's mom, takes Kevin out to play miniature golf and then to dinner, where Kevin totally nails her on her doing that very thing. And it's a shocking, creepy, and devastating scene.
Right around dessert, you can ask about drugs. Real careful, like, because you don't want to scare me into, like, lying my head off. So you have to say how you've experimented. Then finally, once you've sucked up that entire bottle of wine, you can go all gooey-eyed and say how nice it is to spend quality time together. You can scooch over and put your arm around my shoulder. Give it a little squeeze.
Movies like this, I think, have a hard time getting made because people want to go to the theater, to the cinema, to be uplifted, to escape. This rubs your face in the utter darkness of things. So, John, I move that we give We Need to Talk About Kevin a Dionysus Award for the most philosophically courageous and unrelenting movie of the year.
I'll vote for that as long as there's no implied suggestion that our listeners, particularly those who haven't had kids yet, should go out and watch it.
John, you want your art to be comforting. Art is sometimes discomforting.
I love you, kiddo.
It's Philosophy Talk with the Dionysus Awards honoring the most philosophically compelling movies of 2011.
So, John, I saw a great movie that blew my mind. The Tree of Life, directed by Terrence Malick, who only makes a movie once every, I don't know, 4 or 5 years, it seems. It's an amazingly philosophically ambitious and, I think, lyrical and beautiful movie. Have you seen The Tree of Life?
Yes, I saw it. I liked it very much. I'm always well disposed towards Terrence Malick because I understood that he studied philosophy with our colleague Dagfinn Follestal.
You're at Stanford, right?
Yes, I like to think a little bit of our department is in each of his movies. In this movie, you have a fairly mundane, not absolutely trivial, but a little period of a couple people's life, chiefly Sean Penn, where he's, as I understood it, overcoming some bitterness he had towards his father about the way his father handled the death of his brother.
Hey, Dad. I'm sorry I said what I said. I think about him every day. I just shouldn't have said what I did, and I'm sorry.
The Tree of Life is a kind of complicated movie. It's a small story of loss and love and alienation told set basically in the 1950s in Texas. But then the thing that's so unusual about it, this small story of this small human drama is told against a cosmological backdrop, right? It's told against the backdrop of here's how the universe came to be, here's how life came to be, and it's always, and the thing that makes it philosophically ambitious, it's driven by the question, why are we here? What are our lives for? What are they about?
Father.
I never missed a day of work.
Mother.
I tithed every Sunday.
Always you wrestle inside me.
But now, is this cosmological story, is this somehow going on in Sean Penn's mind? Is this kind of why he, I guess, forgives and forgets his father for something about the death of his brother? Or is this just for us?
No, I think it's going on. I think the movie says our lives unfold in the cosmos, which is a created cosmos, which has a source beyond us. And so I think this is a deeply Christian, deeply religious movie. I mean, all the characters, the mother especially, she's a very prayerful woman. You hear them praying. And the prayer is all about, the praying and the reflection is all about, why are we here? What is this for?
Lord.
And this movie puts that question to you with a kind of urgency. Here is the drama of human life. Here is the vast cosmos. This small drama of human life is part of this vast thing. But why? Right? I mean, that's the fundamental question that we all ask ourselves in our reflective moments.
So it's the most philosophical and yet the most religious of movies.
Well, it's philosophical because it probes the question, why am I here? What is this for? How does the drama of human life fit within the vast cosmos? Look, most of the time we just go about our daily lives not worrying about this stuff. But the religious consciousness, the philosophical consciousness says, don't just go about your daily life as if you're just mired in the everyday. Reflect.
We've been discussing The Tree of Life, Terrence Malick's very rich, interesting, very religious, very philosophical movie. I think you really want to give it an award, and so do I, but I'm going to let you come up with the precise award we should give it.
I think this movie is a masterpiece of both filmmaking and sort of philosophizing through film and reflecting through film. I can't imagine a more philosophically ambitious movie. So I think we should give it a prize, an award, not just tied to this year, not just tied to next year, but tied to any possible year. That is, I think, the 2011 Dionysus Award for the most philosophically ambitious movie possible goes to The Tree of Life.
Life, my life. I search for you. My hope.
It's Philosophy Talk with the Dionysus Awards, honoring the most philosophically compelling movies of 2011.
And we've got a nomination from the floor. Christina in Santa Ana, California. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Christina.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, Christina, what philosophically rich movie is on your mind this year? What do you want to nominate for us?
I'd like to nominate In Time.
So tell us a little bit about that movie and why you want to nominate it.
Well, In Time takes place in a possible future in which humans are genetically programmed to stop aging at the age of 25. And from then on, they have 1 year left to live, and they have a countdown clock ticking down on their arm. In this reality, time has replaced money as their currency. So, for instance, instead of buying a loaf of bread for $6, it would cost 6 minutes of your life. And people spend their days spending and earning this time. In the ghettos, like where Justin Timberlake's character Will Solace is from, people are literally living day to day, waking up each morning hoping that they have 24 hours left to live. And in the wealthier areas, like where Amanda Seyfried's character Sylvia Weiss is from, people can theoretically live forever, earning millions of years.
There's a scene in the movie that captures this, where the two main characters, are describing to each other when their clock started, and it's a phenomenological experience to have your clock start.
I was in the street, almost knocked me over. My year was gone in a week, we were so in debt. After that, I lived day to day.
Mine was a little different. It woke me.
But Christina, I'm going to ask you a question. Why would you want to give this movie a Dionysus Award? I want you to defend this choice.
Okay, there's a lot of philosophical questions in it, but there's three that interest me the most. One, if we know almost exactly how long we have to live, you can see it counting down, how would we live our lives differently? And two, there's a scene in the movie where Justin Timberlake's character, Will Solace, his mother, is trying to get to him, but she only has a few minutes of her life left. And no one is willing to give up their life to save her life.
My son is meeting me. He'll pay the difference.
Can't do that. Policy.
Please. It's a 2-hour walk. I have an hour and a half.
Then you better run.
And I find that very ethically compelling. And the third question I find really compelling is, at the end, Will Solace and this Amanda Seyfried's character, Sylvia Weiss, they steal time from the rich to give to those that are poor. And that is also has moral issues in and of itself.
Christina, I kind of agreed with the three positive things you said. But to me, the movie reached a kind of a decision point early on when the Justin Timberlake character meets a fellow and actually saves his life, although it's not clear he wanted his life saved. And this guy had lots of years, and he just gave them all to Justin Timberlake because he'd lived for 100 years, although he didn't look any different than any of the other. They all look 25. He'd lived for 105 years, and he didn't want to go on living it. But they didn't really explore that. And it seemed to me that that was a problem in the movie. It couldn't make up its mind whether it wanted to be an action movie or a philosophical thriller. And in the end, it didn't do either of them quite as well as I would have liked. I wish you'd been the director instead of whoever was.
I do grant the idea behind this is interesting. The social structure is really interesting. There are time zones, and people live in time zones according to how much time they have left. The poor with not much time live in time zone 12, I guess. It's like the ghetto. And the rich live in the time zone 4, which is called New Greenwich. And people there have, like, hundreds of years, thousands of years. And one of the things that happens in New Greenwich is nobody's ever in a hurry, right? So Justin Timberlake, for a complicated reason, ends up in New Greenwich at one point, and people know he doesn't belong there.
You're not from around here, are you? You do everything a little too fast.
Not everything.
Things like that in the movie are kind of cool. I would love to see this premise in the hands of a masterful director like Ridley Scott or somebody who's used to directing dark, futuristic movies. In the hands of the actual director of In Time, you know what it feels like to me? It feels like somebody who took their first screenwriting class and had a good idea, but deserves maybe a C- in execution, right? It's badly acted, the script is awful, and it's incoherent because they can't figure out just what John said, what kind of movie it wants to be. So it doesn't have a consistent tone at one point. It careens from being an action thing to being this deep social commentary thing to this escapist trap. It's a mess. So I'm sorry to say, this is going to have to live without a Dionysus Award.
Oh, well.
Christina, I want to thank you for drawing it to our attention. I don't think I would have seen it otherwise.
All right. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're taking a philosophical look at the movies of 2011 for our fourth annual Dionysus Awards.
In our next segment, we'll take more suggestions from listeners and special guests, and we'll present our final Dionysus Awards.
Suggestions from the floor and so much more when Philosophy Talk continues. Real in Rio, an Oscar-nominated song from the 2011 animated film Rio. This is the Dionysus Awards, and I'm John Perry. You're listening to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor, and we're talking about the most philosophically compelling movies of last year.
Before we get to our final Dionysus Award winner, we're joined by Jan Krawitz. She's a documentary filmmaker who also teaches in the Department of Art and Art History at Stanford. Jan, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
I'm happy to be here.
Jan, there was a documentary this past year by major director Werner Herzog, one of my favorites, actually. The movie was Cave of Forgotten Dreams. Now, many of our listeners thought this was a great film. They nominated it for a Dionysus Award. Now, you're a documentary filmmaker yourself, so we thought we'd invite you to tell us about this film. Tell us just a little bit about it.
Well, Cave of Forgotten Dreams is a journey to the caves of Chauvet, which are in France, that have recently been discovered. They house cave paintings that date back to 32,000 years. The cave is not open to the public, and Herzog was able to get papal dispensation, as it were, to go in with a very, very small camera crew under very, very restrictive conditions for about 4 or 5 days to film in there. So most of the filming occurs within the cave, and then he does some exterior talking head interviews with people who are working in the caves, anthropologists, musicians, and so forth. The film was shot in 3D. I had the experience of seeing it in a commercial theater in 3D, and it really is a pretty visceral experience when the film first shows up. So he uses the caves as a point of departure to talk about lofty issues like when man first attained a spirit and what is humanness and some other elusive philosophical musings.
These images are memories of long-forgotten dreams. Is this their heartbeat or ours? Will we ever be able to understand the vision of the artists across such an abyss of time?
Now, I take it the movie, as a movie, it does more for me than just put me in the cave by myself, maybe with a museum-type guide. I take it the measure of whether it's worthy of a Dionysus Award is how much more it does for me, or one measure, how much more the movie as a movie does for me than, just my first-hand experience would be.
Well, I would say the experience of going to the film as opposed to going with a docent to the cave itself is Herzog. Okay, that's the distinguishing factor, that any Herzog film that you see, you are sort of seduced into the sensibility of Herzog and you can't get out of it. I mean, his point of view is like so specific that it really doesn't allow for any other framing of whatever the film purports to be. And he even talks about, you know, that he directs landscapes in the same way that he directs actors. And I think that's what's going on in this film. He's really using the cave as a point of departure to explore things that preoccupy him about, you know, life and history and who we are and spirituality and humanness and all of that.
After carbon dating, there are strong indications that some overlapping figures were drawn almost 5,000 years apart. The sequence and duration of time is unimaginable for us today. We are locked in history, and they were not.
So if you look at a film like Grizzly Man, I mean, that film is not so much about Timothy Treadwell, who, you know, communed with the grizzlies, but about Herzog pontificating about man versus nature and so on and so forth. So I think that this, absolutely, I think, of course, he goes too far and of course he takes great liberties, but that's why we know and love Herzog films.
But now I sense that you yourself were a little ambivalent here. Sometimes you say what seemed to be really nice things about him, and other times you use words like pontificating, which... for us philosophers, it's a sensitive point. It's not a good thing to do.
Well, it's not my style of filmmaking, should I say that? But I certainly appreciate his body of work, his sensibility, and every new film, you never know what's going to be there. You know, I have this theory of film as like being ventriloquy, where even in documentary, I feel like, you know, we use film as a conduit through which we express our ideas. It can be aesthetically, artistically, philosophically, and so on. Well, he's a little more overt. Because he eschews things like cinema verite and observational style shooting, he's all over his films in terms of, you know, a very, very directed narration, a very, very singular and unambiguous point of view.
So, Jack, we got you out here as a documentary filmmaker and for your expert opinion. Lots of our listeners have nominated this movie, Cave of Forgotten Dreams, for a Dionysus Award. And we want to know, what do you think? Is this worthy of a Dionysus Award? We'll be guided somewhat by your view.
I would say if your criteria is provocative films that make you think and make you think about lofty issues, yes. I would say if the criteria is, are you thinking a lot about the issues of the film once the film is over? No.
Well, then on that note, I'm going to say, John, Werner Herzog's Cave of Forgotten Dreams is a good try, a good attempt, but it's not worthy of a Dionysus Award. We have a high standard here.
Yeah, I'd give the cave an award, but forget about the film.
So, Jan, this has been a great conversation, an informative conversation, and I thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me here.
Are we today possibly the crocodiles who look back into an abyss of time when we see the paintings of Chauvet Cave?
It's Philosophy Talk's fourth annual Dionysus Award Show, and we've got another nomination from the floor. Maureen in Dartmouth, Massachusetts, welcome.
Hi, Ken. Hi, John.
And what movie would you like to nominate for our consideration?
I'd like to nominate the film Melancholia.
Melancholia. Now, that's an interesting one. Tell our audience a little bit about that movie.
Melancholia is billed as the most beautiful film about the end of the world, and indeed it is. The Earth will collide with a massive planet named appropriately Melancholia. And the tactic Lars von Trier takes is to give us a family drama. Surprise. Justine, the main character, the protagonist, is getting married. And you see the wedding day unfold as a series of personal and psychological disasters.
I'm really sorry. I'm thrilled about this wedding. And I know it's costing John a lot of money.
John's filthy rich. He needs to shut up about it. It's not about the cost. It's just that I thought
You really wanted this?
But I do.
Michael has tried to get through to you all evening, to no avail.
That's not true. I smile and I smile and I smile.
You're lying to all of us.
After Justine has fallen into a massive depression, as the planet heads closer to the Earth, Justine becomes increasingly calm as the other characters become increasingly panicked.
I take it this was one of von Trier's insights that he had while he was being treated for depression, that depressed people are often very good in crises. I mean, you know, kind of, oh, the world's ending. Well, that's about what I expected. How can I help this young man not be too terrified?
John, I don't think it's generalizing about depressed people. I think Justine liberates herself from life, from a commitment to anything that is life-affirming. And she actually says in the second part of the movie, there's a scene in which they realize, you know, the thing's going to hit the Earth, and it's the end. And she basically says, that's all right with me. This planet is evil. Life on this planet is evil.
And when I say we're alone. Life is only on Earth. And not for long.
I guess you could say there's a kind of existentialist motif here, in which the existentialist says, at the bottom, there is nothing. But at the bottom of that nothing, the human thing is to embrace it openly and not fear it, not deny it, not open it up. So Justine, in the end, I mean, she has, of the possible ways of reacting to this end, she has the most kind of affirming way of reacting to this end, right? We build this magic tent, we go up on the hill, it's a beautiful scene, and we embrace the moment. And Justine is the only one that kind of courageously embraces the nothingness that's at the bottom of all existence. So she's kind of an existentialist hero.
So, the winner of the Dionysus Award for 2011 for the most philosophically rich film about the meaningless end of the world and how depressed people are well equipped to deal with it is Melancholia.
Ladies and gentlemen, we've waited a while for this. A toast to the bride and the groom.
Justine and Michael.
Justine and Michael.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. It's our fourth annual Dionysus Awards show. We're joined now by Malcolm Turvey. He's a movie historian from Sarah Lawrence College. He's also author of The Filming of Modern Life, European avant-garde film of the 1920s. Malcolm, welcome to the Dionysus Awards.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
What movie are you going to nominate?
I would like to nominate David Cronenberg's A Dangerous Method, which came out last year.
This was a movie about Freud and Jung.
That is correct, yes. It was about Freud, Jung, but also a young woman named Sabina Spielrein, who was a patient and then purportedly a lover of Jung's, but also somebody who corresponded with and met Freud, too.
Okay, so this, you know, these are major figures in the history of psychoanalysis, and it sounds like an interesting sort of bioepic, but philosophically, what themes does it raise philosophically?
It raises a philosophical issue that Cronenberg has been interested in a lot of his films, which is the issue of transformation and whether human beings can ever really fundamentally transform themselves. Jung, and I believe Cronenberg too, thinks they can and they should. In the film, Jung talks about this right at the end in the final conversation he has with Sabina.
I don't want to just open a door and show the patient his illness, squatting there like a toad. I want to try and find a way to help the patient reinvent himself, to send him off on a journey at the end of which is waiting the person he was always intended to be.
It's no good making yourself ill in the process.
Only the wounded physician can hope to heal.
So in a way, he comes across as the visionary thinker or scientist in the film, whereas Freud comes across as conservative.
But now, from a philosophical point of view, I thought the most interesting character was not Freud or Jung or Sabina, but Freud's student and patient that Jung takes over for a while, Otto Gross. Now, Otto Gross is described by Freud as brilliant.
Right.
But he's convinced that once you realize that all these repressions are making you miserable, the natural thing to do, the rational thing to do, is to quit acting repressed.
It seems to me a measure of the true perversity of the human race that one of its very few reliably pleasurable activities should be the subject of so much hysteria and repression.
But not to repress yourself is to unleash all kinds of dangerous and destructive forces.
Our job is to make our patients capable of freedom.
And he influences Jung. This is the influence that gets Jung into bed with Sabina.
That's right.
And I think it's a philosophical challenge. I mean, that Freud and Jung don't seem to face up to explicitly, although maybe they do implicitly, namely, if this is what you believe, that all of our sexual mores are due to repression, why not just change?
You know, that's a really good question. And I'm glad you brought that back around to what gets Jung into bed with Sabina, what keeps him in bed, because he's this interesting character. He's a much more narratively interesting character than the Freud character, who seems in many ways utterly conventional, utterly safe and conservative. And Jung is there in this deep sexual exploration with this strange woman with whom he's broken some kind of boundary with because he's her therapist, right? And he comes to being her lover. But all the while, he wants to maintain his conventional marriage to his conventional wife. What's up with that, dude? Psychoanalyze that dude in either Freudian or Jungian terms. What's up with that dude?
Well, this is a very Jungian idea, right? That the self is fragmented. So you could say that Jung in the film is really between two figures, right? The Freudian father figure and this guy, Otto Gross, right? And in a way, he's trying to synthesize both points of view. He stays with his wife, right? As he puts it at one point, my wife is you know, the foundation of my house, whereas my lover is the perfume in the air. So he's really trying to find a way to reconcile these two sides of his sexual identity. And Freud and Gross, represent these two sides.
So you think Cronenberg really did deeply side with Jung in the nature of a self as possibly essentially fragmented, because the central character, Jung himself exemplifies his own theory, and Cronenberg kind of applies that theory in his filmmaking.
Exactly.
So, Malcolm, you've convinced me. This is a great movie. Talking to you has made me believe it's even better than I first thought. So it clearly deserves a Dionysus Award, John. Don't you agree?
Absolutely. Let's have Malcolm officially nominate it.
Okay. The Dionysus Award for the most philosophically rich depiction of the role of sadism and masochism in human life goes to...
A Dangerous Method.
You think Freud's right? You think all neurosis is of exclusively sexual origin?
I think Freud's obsession with sex probably has a great deal to do with the fact that he never gets any.
You can find a list of all of our Dionysus Award winners and nominees, including many we didn't get to mention on the air, at our website, philosophytalk.org.
And you can sign up to get the free weekly podcast of Philosophy Talk at our website as well. For the final word, we turn to the winner of the award for Fastest Philosophy on the Radio. Ian Scholes, the 60-Second Philosopher.
Ian Scholes, you may not know this, but unless rabies is involved, wolf attacks on humans are extremely rare. But not in the movies. The Liam Neeson movie The Grey is about a bunch of hapless guys being pursued and killed by a bunch of large territorial wolves. Wolf attacks in movies and literature are very common. It probably stems from Jack London and White Fang. There was Jeremiah Johnson, Frozen, Red Riding Hood, not to mention werewolf movies. You think wolves are a bigger threat than the economy? I started thinking about this when I was reading about The Artist, the terrific silentish black and white movie about the transition from silent movies to sound. An article in Slate took a scene in the movie, actually a movie within the movie, in which the hero gets sucked to his death by quicksand. The Slate writer, Daniel Engberg, gives a brief overview of quicksand in the movies, including Lawrence of Arabia, Blazing Saddles, and Princess Bride. Engberg makes the point that The Artist satirizes the use of quicksand in movies, but in point of fact, he argues, the golden age of movie quicksand came after the period in which The Artist is supposed to take place. I've seen many of those movies, most of them Tarzan or Tarzan-ish movies. Unlike actual quicksand, which is more like oatmeal, movie quicksand is hypergravitational, with a supernatural ability to suck victims into its untold depths. There is no escape, unless you have a strong friend in the bank, Tarzan preferably, with a vine or length of rope. Of course, it's not just quicksand and wolves that are misrepresented. Back in the day, black people in movies were just always scaredy cats. This is supposed to be amusing for some reason. Less irritating, butlers are always put upon, and everybody had a butler or a maid. Cabbies are always wisecracking. Cops were dim lugs. The nightclubs were as big as stadiums with full orchestras. And if you heard a lone saxophone on the soundtrack, it meant the hero was going to kiss a looker in evening wear and a cruel gash of a mouth. Everybody wore hats. If you heard this in the soundtrack, it meant you were going to Hong Kong or Singapore. If you heard this in the soundtrack, it meant the wagon train was about to be attacked. Kind of soundtrack racism, really. Among other things not found in real life, the movies give us zombies, vampires, demons, aliens, ruthless industrialists with mad schemes for world domination, and cute chimpanzees. Real chimpanzees are as likely to tear your face off as give you a hug. And don't even get me started on bears. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2012.
Our executive producer is David Demereth.
The program is produced by Devin Strolovich. The director of research is Laura McGuire.
Thanks also to Chris Hoff, Merle Kessler, Dave Millar, Jimmy Tobin, Corey Goldman, and Mark Stone.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from the Templeton Foundation and from various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk,
and the members of KALW San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
Hooray for Hollywood. They hire fellas whose physiques are good. And then they tell them they're the perfect shape men to act like ape men, and they convince them they should. They make them grunt and yell, oh,
and people think.